the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. We're supported by listeners who subscribe, including Miko Silvanoinen, James Swift, Sally Soriano, and Nick Yaksich. Thank you, one and all. And for new subscribers, I've still got the Kona coffee offer going, courtesy of our listener, Russ, who lives in Hawaii and grows that coffee. In a moment, we'll meet today's guest, Chaz W. Freeman, Jr. He is a longtime diplomat. He was Richard Nixon's translator during the opening to China, historically, back in 1972. He served as ambassador to Saudi Arabia and also was an undersecretary of defense. If you haven't subscribed to the program yet, the Kona Coffee offer is good for new subscribers who sign up for an annual subscription. Also, we have a new way for you to support our program by working with GoDaddy.com. They have the best deals on domain name registration and web hosting. I've been doing business with them for over 10 years. They have excellent customer service. And right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth that starts at just $1.99 a month, you'll get your domain name free. To get a special deal that also supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Chaz W. Freeman has been serving our nation as a diplomat and in other roles, for a long time. He's about 10 years older than I am, and he started back in the State Department in 1965. And while I was agitating against the Nixon presidency, he went on the historic trip to China and served as the president's translator at that time. He was appointed by George H.W. Bush as the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he also served in the Clinton administration as an undersecretary of defense. To say that he is savvy in the ways of the world would be an understatement. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining me today.
Privileged to be with you. Please call me Chaz.
Okay, I'll work on that. And Chaz, I got a lot out of your book, which really takes a deep look at the history of U.S.-China relations since the historic Nixon opening. And I want to talk about that a little bit later in the interview. But because you're so knowledgeable about so many world issues and zones of the world, I'd like to get your thoughts, starting with the current situation of John Kerry, the new Secretary of State's shuttle diplomacy between Israel and Palestine. And the Secretary is saying that he's had a breakthrough, that there will be some talks, and there is some movement on the Israeli side as Prime Minister Netanyahu is fast-tracking some legislation that would put any peace deal to a national referendum. How do you size up Kerry's initiatives? Is this a realistic effort on the part of the Obama administration, or is it kind of going through the motions, in your view?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that Mr. Kerry is pretty serious about what he's doing. I also fear, as most people who have looked at this situation for a while have, that it's a quixotic enterprise. What he's basically done is arranged talks about talks. That's an achievement only in the context of decades of failed American diplomacy on this issue. Talks about talks, with no clear parameters for what the talks are meant to produce and no timetable, and no penalties, apparently, for failing to produce a result, are quite a gamble. I wouldn't place many bets on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we saw this in the second George W. Bush term, where there was a renewed desire, the so-called roadmap for peace in the Middle East, and really nothing significant came of it. We ended up with Operation Cast Lead during the lull between the Bush and Obama presidencies, which was, I believe, a black mark on Israel's intentions. And you are a rare bird in the diplomatic world of Washington that you have been willing to criticize policies of the state of Israel. So feel free to express yourself here without any reservation. Do you think Israel is really serious about peace, or are they simply trying to wear down the Palestinians, continue to expand settlements, and essentially elbow them out of the way?
Well, I think it's been pretty clear for decades that Israel is far more interested in grabbing land than it is seizing peace. It has really made no effort whatsoever to come to grips with the Palestinians, except for purposes of appeasing American opinion and I would say sustaining the support of Jews outside Israel, who really do hope that this experiment with the Jewish homeland in the Middle East will work out. The United States has been very heavily committed to Israel at every step, and yet nothing has been produced, and so I think it's very hard to accept sincerity in this case. You mentioned the roadmap. Ariel Sharon, who was then the Prime Minister of Israel, rolled that up and stuck it in the glove compartment and drove off in his own direction, which culminated in Cast Lead, which it is extraordinarily hard to find any serious justification for other than the objective of making life so miserable for the inhabitants of Gaza that they would leave.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the silence of the Obama administration, the resupply of cluster bombs and other materiel to the Israelis following Cast Lead, I just think set a very weak tone during the first term of President Obama. And then when Netanyahu came to Washington and brushed back Obama's proposal and was able to rally Democratic leaders as well as many Republicans to align against a sitting president of the United States, I found that to be a really uncomfortable development and a real a rejection of presidential leadership.
As you said, Cast Lead occurred during a transition from the George W. Bush administration to the Obama administration. It halted just as Obama was about to take office. I don't think Israel wanted to have him come into office with this extremely embarrassing, provocative military operation underway. And President Obama opened his time in office with what we have every reason to believe was a serious effort to redress the extremely difficult and damaged relationship between the United States and the American people in the Muslim world. He went to Ankara and gave a noted speech, and then in Cairo gave a tremendous speech promising a new beginning in Middle East policy. It was that new beginning that Mr. Netanyahu and his flax and supporters here in the United States rebuffed and ultimately defeated in what can only be described, as you put it, as a tremendous humiliation for the President of the United States and indeed for our country. Here is a small, dependent protectorate of the United States in the Middle East dictating to us our own policy and using its influence in our domestic politics to override presidential leadership. That's really rather extraordinary.
And while the tone has shifted somewhat, Chas Freeman, we saw Chuck Hagel had to eat his words when he was quoted once being critical of AIPAC. And most recently, we saw Samantha Power in her confirmation hearings to be UN ambassador, genuflecting before Israel. And let me just stipulate, because I think it's always important so the things won't be taken out of context, I support the honest policies of the state of Israel. I support an even-handed U.S. broker's role in trying to find compromises with the Palestinians. I also support the aspirations of the Palestinian people for either full inclusion in Israel or an independent state. And we have this hysterical control of our Congress and really of the media themes that surface about this and the incredible influence of the Israeli lobby as, evidenced by AIPAC. And so how can the United States really move forward when we subjugate our foreign policy to that of Israel?
Well, I think the difference between Chuck Hagel and Samantha Powers was that Hagel mounted classic rope-a-dope defense. He just sat there and took it, but he didn't grovel. Samantha Powers did grovel, but both did that to the same end. They knew they could not get into office. They could not serve the administration or the American people without subjecting themselves to the humiliation of those Senate hearings. And both of them, at one point or another, were subjected to the same campaigns of innuendo and quotations taken out of context and flat lies that have derailed so many other people in the past, including myself, I might say.
Indeed. I was going to inject that next, because you were considered for a post by Dennis Blair when he was the DNI to join the National Intelligence Council, actually to chair it. And there was a whisper campaign. Maybe they didn't whisper. They were kind of shouting in objection to your nomination to that post.
Yeah, well, the difference there, of course, was that that post, which I actually accepted with great reluctance after resisting it, since I had already given 30 years of my life to public service and was having a nice time beyond it. That position is not subject to Senate confirmation, so there was really no way I could clear my name. And had I gone on in it, anything that the National Intelligence Council produced would have immediately been subjected to a slanderous, or not to say libelous, campaign of derogation by the same people who went after Hagel and earlier after Powers. So I simply couldn't do my job of establishing credibility and a better record of accuracy for the U.S. intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially the difference. But the fact is that George Washington warned us 230 years ago against a passionate attachment to a foreign country. And we have such a passionate attachment. And we cannot be an honest broker in the Israel-Palestine or Israel-Arab context, because we are the principal subsidizer of the state of Israel, and we are wholeheartedly in emotional terms on the Israeli side as a people. Our news media, our knowledge, our public dialogue and discourse are all very pro-Israeli, so much so that I think we have helped to enable behavior on the part of Israel, which is extremely self-destructive. And that, of course, saying that is, of course, what got me into trouble and what got Hagel into trouble. That is to say, I don't think that it's an act of friendship to give a drunk the keys to your car or to coddle someone who is destroying himself with self-destructive, even suicidal behavior. There's no way that the state of Israel can hope to survive over the long term if its only answer to every problem is the use of force,
mm-hmm.
if it has no diplomatic strategy, and if it is not prepared to compromise, make peace, and deal respectfully with its neighbors, whether Palestinian or others. And it is the propensity to use force, the That's the sort of concept that might makes right, and that the only security one can get is at the point of a gun that most threatens Israel, and that and the occupation, which has corroded its moral standing and authority. Taken the original Zionist state, which had many admirable characteristics, and damaged it enormously.
And Chas Freeman, one of the few areas where I feel the Obama administration has had some success is in fending off Israel's demands for a preemptive strike on Iran. And our own intelligence estimates show that Iran is not even close to developing a nuclear weapon, and there are honest doubts about whether they really have that intention or ever will follow through on it. And yet we see Israel continually demanding that the red line be drawn, and then saying the red line has been crossed and that we must act. Tell me your thoughts about this looming confrontation and how long Obama can resist Israel's demands.
Well, I think that there's no question that Iran has been successfully demonized in American politics, and indeed there's a lot not to like about Iran. And one has to imagine that having read the Israeli playbook, after all the Israelis duped John F. Kennedy and built nuclear weapons of their own while denying they were doing it, that the Iranians are working off the same playbook. And so I take the Israeli concerns about this seriously. A nuclear-armed Iran would cost Israel its monopoly position on nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and it would act as a constraint on Israel's ability, as it has done over the past decades, to use force to attack its neighbors at will, since it wouldn't be sure what the Iranian reaction might be. So from the Israeli point of view, there are serious security issues involved and a suspicion that the Iranians are following their own example, and I think that has to be taken seriously. That said, it appears that the Iranian strategy is to develop all of the capabilities to build a weapon, but that there has not yet been a decision to actually do so, and that, therefore, this issue remains negotiable. And with a new leadership in Tehran, there's an opportunity, an opening to mount such negotiations. And it's precisely for that reason that Mr. Netanyahu went on a Sunday talk shows here to renew the threat to Iran and to talk it up, and to say that diplomatic discussions were useless with Iran, at the same time Israel's supporters here in AIPAC and other organizations have remounted their lobbying campaign to ratchet up sanctions. Well, this is not promising. And if I were Iranian, I suspect that having received almost daily threats of an air attack and a submarine-based missile attack from Israel and the United States, I would be looking for a deterrent to those attacks. So I think it's really rather interesting that Iran doesn't seem to have made the decision to go nuclear, and the reason it hasn't, in the words of its supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, is that it considers nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction to be immoral and un-Islamic. You can laugh at that, but I think that's wrong. These are people who take their religion far too seriously for my taste, but you have to understand that they do follow the precepts of their holy book and their religious scholars.
Let me move to the expanding civil war in Syria, which risks becoming a regional conflict. We have a breakdown in Iraq right now. The civil war that we suppressed is really kind of gaining momentum. Some of those fighters are moving from Iraq into Syria. There are other foreign fighters, including those aligned with al-Qaeda. And President Obama, I was supporting his holdout on any kind of military support for this array of rebel groups aligned against the Assad dictatorship. What are your thoughts about that recent decision? And is there a way out or even a way forward in Syria?
Well, there are two things going on with Syria. I don't think it's quite accurate to say that we suppressed the civil war in Iraq. Actually, we ignited it. The secularist struggle there, the struggle between Shia and Sunni, to the extent it existed at all, had been peaceful and rhetorical prior to our arrival.
Well, my point, Chaz, was that the so-called surge, and I don't believe in the myth of the surge, but we paid Sunnis to stop shooting, and we essentially segregated Sunnis and Shia, particularly in Baghdad, with a kind of ethnic separation, and also by empowering the Shiite Maliki government, we're now seeing scores settled by Sunnis there. So my feeling is that we were able to tamp down some of it while we made our exit, but it seemed inevitable to me that it would resurface.
I don't disagree with that. I would simply say that before our arrival, there was no such religious warfare in progress. That, oddly enough, the main achievement of this surge was to install a pro-Iranian regime in Baghdad, which one would think, given our thoughts about Iran, was not to our advantage.
Indeed.
In any event, the secular struggle, the Shiite-Sunni struggle in that we catalyzed, at least in Iraq, and failed to control as we departed, has now spread more widely in the Middle East. It infected Bahrain, which remains where the government, the royal family, remain in a state of siege from much of their public, which is Shia. And it has now infected Syria, with the result that Lebanon, too, has been dragged in. And in effect, the entire structure that Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, the British and French bureaucrats who dismembered the Ottoman Empire and created all these states of Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, and Jordan, that map that they drew is in danger of being erased, and the states that they created are in danger of rearranging themselves, collapsing, and so forth. So I think the stakes in Syria are very high, and they're both aspects of a secular struggle that rivals the 30-year war in Europe, and of geopolitical struggles between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example, or the United States and Iran. And there, I think it's the sad thing is that with almost 100,000 Syrians having perished, there really has been no effective effort made to halt the strife. And that's perhaps because the strife serves a useful purpose. If you can't overthrow the Assad regime and thereby remove him as an asset for Iran strategically, then throwing Syria into anarchy does the job just as well. And Syria becomes not an asset but a liability for Iran, and that seems to be the larger geopolitical objective for some of the players in this very tragic scene.
And so
I don't like the idea of our joining into arming religious fanatics, however anti-Iranian they may be.
Okay, that was the point I was looking for. Thank you very much. There are so many other things, and I definitely want to get to China. Let's take one last stop in the Middle East. When the generals removed Morsi from power in Egypt, was that a coup? And what role did the U.S. play?
Of course it was a coup. I doubt the U.S. played any role. Other than perhaps attempting to foolishly to promote some democratic alternative to the Muslim Brotherhood and thereby encouraging the forces that came out in the street and were used as an excuse by General Sisi to run his coup. When is a coup not a coup? Mm-hmm. When the U.S. law says that a coup has consequences that are unwelcome and perhaps unwise. Faced with a choice between bad laws and bad outcomes, we choose to go with the outcomes. And that is a problem for our constitutional democracy. It's far from unique, but it is a scofflaw kind of behavior to which we ought to object. The real answer to that sort of situation is not to pass stupid laws that constrain the discretionary authority of the president to deal with contingencies abroad, for the Congress to exercise the oversight of foreign affairs that it should, and for the Congress to hold the executive accountable for its mistakes rather than to collude in them. So I think this is this whole Egyptian overthrow of the Morsi government, whatever you might think of the Morsi government, was an atrocity.
Well, Chaz, it strikes me as somewhat similar to the move by George W. Bush to force elections by the Palestinians. And then when Hamas won those elections, the U.S. and Israel imposed even greater hardships on Palestinians in retaliation. And it seems that we like democracy as long as the result meets with our approval. But when it doesn't, we interfere.
That's right. In the case of Hamas, which is remains the only elected government in Palestine, we tried very hard to generate a coup against it. And when the coup failed, we imposed sanctions on the elected government. I don't think our complicity in the overthrow of the Morsi government is anywhere near as obvious or clear as it was in that case. But I think you're right. The basic principle is democracy is okay as long as it produces the outcomes we want. But if it doesn't, then we don't like it.
Okay, and I can't resist one more stop in the Middle East, Benghazi. I feel that the Republicans seized a moment and played it very badly. I also believe that there was an apparent cover-up by the Obama team. But it wasn't the kind of cover-up that the Republicans were charging. It was related to the true function of the facility in Benghazi, which was a CIA operation and not really a State Department post. And so when the attack occurred last September 11th, my impression is that the Obama administration closed ranks in order to protect the CIA's covert operation there, and that's what led to the appearance of an attempted cover-up. Do you agree, disagree, have a different interpretation?
No, I think you have it exactly right. That was not a Foreign Service or State Department installation. It was a CIA armed outpost engaged in activities that normally would not enjoy diplomatic immunity. The events that occurred there were certainly a tragedy, and the reactions of various parties, primarily the CIA and the military, to them did not cover them with glory. And I agree, the administration attempted to cover for its military and intelligence failures.
Chaz W. Freeman has a new book out called Interesting Times, China, America, and the Shifting Balance of Prestige. And you have been a China watcher. You started at the State Department in 65. You were at the China desk. And because of your language skills, you were selected to be the interpreter between President Nixon and Mao Zedong in 1972. And your book draws on your rich historical knowledge of China. And I would like to just invite people to read it. And you, of course, are welcome to reference historical elements. But for the purposes of this interview, I'd like to focus on the current state of U.S.-China affairs and the obvious pivot by the Obama administration to beef up our military and diplomatic presence in Asia and in the Pacific in particular. And I'd like to open here with a quote from the introduction to your book. You write, "The logic of the U.S. pivot derives from its attribution to China of ambitions to become a, quote, peer military competitor, end quote, of the United States, or to impose a, quote, Chinese version of the Monroe Doctrine, end quote, on Asia. But there is precious little evidence in Chinese policy and political discourse to support the thesis that China aspires to emulate the United States in either way. The PLA, the People's Liberation Army, remains focused on internal security, the defense of the Chinese homeland against neighbors with a history of invading it, and countering the powerful U.S. naval and air forces constantly mapping and probing its coastal defenses. So expand on that a little bit, if you would, Chaz, because many people have a very simple notion of China's intentions. They know that we owe China a lot of money and that they have leverage over us in that respect. But you're really offering a very clear sense of sharp limits on any military expansionism intended by the current Chinese government.
Well, let me first make a small correction. I did not interpret between Nixon and Mao, in part because Nixon didn't want anybody there from the State Department. But I was the principal American interpreter on the trip, and it certainly was a fascinating one.
All right, forgive you.
No, no problem. Let's go to your main point, which I think is vitally important. To begin with, we have a bad habit. It's a normal human habit of doing what is called in the intelligence community mirror imaging. That is, when we don't really understand the object of our attention, the other side, as it were, we attribute to the other side the motives and the behavior that we would indulge in if we were they. But that ignores the fact that we're not the same and our circumstances are not the same. In the case of the Chinese, they are obsessed with their national weakness, not with their strength. From 1842, the Opium War, right through to the end of the Cold War, they were in a position in which they were invaded on multiple occasions. Something over 100 million Chinese died during domestic and international fighting on Chinese soil, and they were humiliated. And this does not inspire an expansionist mentality. What it does inspire is a great concern for your defense. Second, China is incredibly vulnerable even today. It has almost 1.4 billion people living in an area the size of the United States, including Alaska and Hawaii, but with one-third the arable land, and considerably less, something like a fourth as much water. It just doesn't have the margin for error that we and many other countries do. Its leaders are focused on reestablishing its wealth, saving its people from poverty and from starvation, managing a society the size of which no one else has ever successfully managed in the course of history. Third, China doesn't have the foreign policy leeway that we do. We have two oceans on either side. We have many allies, which we built during the Cold War. Of course, before World War II, we had no allies. We were, like the Chinese, very leery of entangling alliances. The Chinese have got some neighbors who are pretty intimidating. To the north, they have Russia, which bit off large parts of Chinese territory in the 18th and 19th century, and with which their relationship has historically been very problematic. When Nixon went to China, the Chinese had just finished having a border war with the Russians in their northeast on the Ussuri River. A little farther away, they have the Japanese, who invaded China in 1931 and didn't leave until 1945, and in the process killed perhaps as many as 35 million Chinese. A little south of that, there's the 7th Fleet, which guards Taiwan, which all Chinese regard as part of China, and perpetuates the division of their country. South of that, there's Vietnam, which, as we have reason to know, is a pretty formidable fighting force, and which has a history of thousands of years of troubled relationships with China. And proceeding to the west, you have India, with which China fought a border war in 1962, and which regards itself as, in every respect, a rival of China strategically. That's without mentioning neighbors like North Korea, which is a nuclear-armed nutcase, and Pakistan, which, whatever its merits may be, is pretty unstable.
Mm-hmm.
China also has a border with Afghanistan. And so if you're Chinese, the last thing on earth you're thinking about is trying to project your power against the United States and dislodge the United States from our global role.
And Chaz, if I can lift another quote here, in the chapter entitled What Mr. Nixon Wrought, you note that China has expanded its investments in military spending in recent years. And you detail some of the commentary you just offered here. And then you write, China has fought wars on its borders in modern times, but despite its rising power, it has not pressed a single territorial dispute to resolution through the use of force. China's maritime borders remain unresolved, but all but one of its land frontiers with India have been demarcated through peaceful negotiations. Now, that's a very important statement, because in the extremes in the United States, those who comment on foreign policy characterize China as a rising military threat to the United States. And I think it's very important to put rational frames around those rather extreme concerns.
Well, I think it's really quite startling when you think about it that China was willing to wait from 1949 until 1997 peacefully to negotiate the return of Hong Kong from the British, who had taken it in 1842 in order to safeguard their right to sell dangerous drugs to the Chinese without Chinese government interference, the Opium War. And it's not the case that China threatens the U.S. homeland or threatens the United States. What China threatens is the supremacy of the United States in the Western Pacific that we have enjoyed since we defeated the Imperial Japanese Navy. And the only threat it poses is to our ability to exercise a hegemonic role in that region. And we have to ask ourselves, do we really need to dominate the waters up to 12 miles from the Chinese coast? What would we think if China or some other country did that to us? And that is the essence of the issue. But we never discuss this. We talk about threats without defining what they are, and we talk about competition without describing what field it's taking place in or what the stakes are.
Much later in the book, you write, the fact is that while China is no longer a weak country and is no longer the least bit isolated, it is still a poor country, and parts of it remain desperately primitive. Chinese leaders' modesty in the face of foreign amazement at their country's economic progress is not feigned. It reflects a realistic appreciation born of personal experience with conditions in places like Gansu and Tibet of the enormous challenges and the several decades their country must traverse before it can achieve its national goal of becoming a moderately well-off society. Now, against this frame, Chaz, we have cyber warfare that is being robustly and aggressively expanded. General Alexander, who also heads the NSA, runs the Cyber Command at the Pentagon. They've announced 40 different units, 13 of which will be focused on aggressive, offensive cyber warfare. And first and foremost, I believe this to be a new form of war that requires the consent of Congress, and I haven't seen any move to secure that or even for a realistic debate about it. But I consider a cyber attack like Stuxnet the same as putting boots on the ground or launching a missile. And I don't consider China to be innocent. I know about that building in Shanghai that we're told is where all these hackers work 24/7 to compromise the integrity of our systems, right up to the Pentagon itself. But give me your thoughts about cyber warfare, and in particular, the way we are engaging with China in that respect.
I think there are three issues here, and we need to separate them. One is domestic surveillance, which is clearly a violation of the Fourth Amendment and our freedom from warrantless search and our ability to enjoy the security of our homes and our property and our own thoughts without others constantly monitoring them. That's one element. The second is cyber espionage, which is a serious violation of intellectual property rights, and it's one the U.S. and China have agreed to talk about. It's not unique to China, but China seems in many respects to be the most active perpetrator of it, or at least the most commonly detected perpetrator of it. And we need to work that out, because we can't live in a world where intellectual property is subject to lawless pilferage. But the third area, the one you allude to, is really by far the most serious. If you think about cyberspace, it is a strategic domain like the land, the sea, the air, or outer space. You know, the land surrounded by the sea, which means you can get to most points on the land from the sea, which makes the sea a more flexible strategic domain. The air is above both, so it's a higher domain than either. And above that is space, which is higher yet. And one always wants the high ground in the military struggle. And above that is cyberspace, which permeates everything that modern humanity does. And typically, having discovered this new domain, the first thing we do is militarize it. And as you suggested, that's something we've done rather aggressively. You mentioned Stuxnet. We've said explicitly that were something like that be done to us, we would regard it as an act of war deserving a full response from us. And yet we carried it out, confident, I suppose, that the Iranians would not respond, or could not, perhaps. China's different. They can and will respond. And I think one of the reasons China has built such a modest nuclear strike force and is content to remain with a no-first-use military nuclear doctrine is because they now see cyber war as an adequate substitute in the realm of deterrence. And I think they could do huge damage to us in the cyber domain, as we could to them. And we're going to have to come to some sort of mutual assured destruction doctrine of mutual deterrence to manage this, because it is a really serious thing. And when it, when people in this country talk about air-sea battle, deep strikes into China, taking down Chinese industrial establishment with cyber attacks, I get really worried, because we don't seem to understand that what we can do to others, they can do to us.
I appreciate your remarks about the unconstitutionality of domestic surveillance. Overall, what is your take on Ed Snowden's disclosures of classified information?
Well, he fits in a long, long historical pattern of civil disobedience by Americans. Henry Thoreau would have recognized him. And he does seem to have been quite careful to limit his actual disclosures to material relating to the domestic surveillance arena. Sometimes, of course, that is justified by reference to foreign events. He's made a few departures from that, which I think was a mistake. But unfortunately, we have such a garrison state with so much secrecy and strange doctrines like official secrets, which we never had in the past, that the only way we can find out about what our government is doing is through whistleblowers. That's what he was trying to do, and while I myself, having served in the government for 30 years, have to confess I probably would not have done that, I think we've learned a lot, and he's been, on balance, a very useful revealer of things that we need to know as citizens.
Well, I think it's remarkable, and I commend you for offering that point of view, because given that you were going to serve on the National Intelligence Council, I wasn't quite sure what your comment would be, and
maybe that's why I'm not there.
Well, I guess so, but I fully agree with you, and I don't think that Mr. Snowden will win Best Fugitive Oscar, and they won't have Jason Bourne awarded to him. I think his move into Hong Kong and then getting stuck in Moscow certainly wasn't exactly what he had in mind. But that, to me, is a distraction from what he chose to do, which is to expose to us what's been going on. And, Chaz, I recently interviewed Russell Tice, one of the NSA whistleblowers, and he disclosed to me that he personally was involved in installing wiretaps on Senator Dianne Feinstein, who now chairs the Intelligence Committee. He said that he was involved in wiretaps on Senate candidate Barack Obama in 2004, that he saw the orders to wiretap a judge named Sam Alito after he had been nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I find Russ Tice credible. I can't prove his assertions. And, of course, the NSA didn't permit him to retain any documents that he could use to prove this. But if it's true, it suggests that many of our top leaders are compromised and that the real deep state government is run by General Alexander.
Well, the real issue in our democracy, if it can still be called that, is oversight. There is no effective oversight. The warrantless wiretap program is authorized by a secret court in secret. That court consists of judges appointed by Chief Justice Roberts, not subject to Senate confirmation. And the aforementioned Senator Feinstein and the others in Congress who have a responsibility and a right to oversight essentially don't exercise that right. We don't have vigorous inquiry in typical times. We have instead a sort of sycophantic wrapping of individuals in patriotic subservience to the garrison state. So essentially, our military officers, who I think are well intentioned and are trying to protect our domestic tranquility as best they can. And the civil service people who work alongside them at NSA, who are similarly well-intentioned, are left with no civilian supervision to do whatever they want to do. And since they are driven to do their utmost, they do it. And we all lose in terms of our personal freedoms and privacy and ultimately our security, I believe.
Chaz Freeman, one more question about China. I have a colleague, a globetrotting journalist named Pepe Escobar. He's Brazilian. He writes for a publication called Asia Times. And he argues, based on his theory, what he calls Pipelinistan, that the real world struggle is over the oil and gas resources in the Caucasus and Caspian Sea region. And his point of view is that the struggle is whether those resources will eventually be diverted east to China, west to Russia in Europe, or south into Pakistan or some other outlet where they could be exported and presumably controlled by the United States. Number one, do you see this area as that kind of flashpoint? And number two, do you see it as driving some of these issues of conflict as at present and into the future?
Well, you know, I think Central Asia has reemerged as an important part of the globe after having been submerged by the Russian and then the Soviet Empire, and I think it has important resources to offer, both physical and human to the world. And essentially, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which China and Russia have organized with the states in that region, is intended to contain great power rivalry and also to suppress political Islam, which might pose a threat not only to Russia with its large Muslim population, but China with its surprisingly surprisingly large Muslim population, many of whom are not ethnic minorities, but Han.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue is being, the area is important. I don't see it as geopolitically central. And I think it is, the issues are being managed with some success. I think oil and gas is a particularly noxious area of public discussion, because the assumption is always that we're motivated somehow by a desire for resources. And we have been in the past. The Standard Oil Company started a disastrous war between Paraguay and Argentina and Bolivia at one point. We obviously befriended Saudi Arabia out of concern that eventually we would not be the world's largest oil exporter. Interestingly, we're going back to 1970, probably for a decade or so, as shale oil and gas come on. And I think we'll see that many of our interests, which have appeared to be driven by oil and gas, in fact, are driven by other considerations. I have great respect for Mr. Escobar, but I don't think in this case that he's quite correct.
All right. Well, Mr. Freeman, Mr. Ambassador Chaz, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today. I really enjoyed our discussion, and you offer a lot of very frank and useful commentary. The new book is Interesting Times, China, America, and the Shifting Balance of Prestige. We've been talking with Chaz W. Freeman, Jr. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Tell me what you think about the remarks of Chaz W. Freeman. Drop me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until